This is the 20th anniversary edition of Functional Medicine Update for June 2002, Volume 22, Number 6. Hello, my name is Jay Johnson, and for the past 20 years, it's been my distinct pleasure and honor to push the buttons and twist the knobs to cut the tape, and more recently to scroll the mouse, which is the production work involved in providing you this monthly update featuring Dr. Jeffrey Bland. Right now, I'd like to take you back to June of 1982, when it all began.
Hello, this is Jeff Bland speaking, and I'd like to welcome you to Volume 1, Number 1 of Metabolic Update, which will be coming out each month from here on, and be apprising you of some of the newest developments, both clinical and research, in the area of nutritional medicine and preventive medicine. I'm very excited about this series because it allows me the opportunity to work in what I feel is probably my strongest area, and that is on research and on writing and developing new associations between disease and the diet link, and getting that information to you, and reducing the amount of travel time that's required for me to be an educator. Hopefully for you it will provide the opportunity to listen to these tapes at your leisure in an environment that's pleasing for maximum information transfer, and then have some time for reflections as it relates to the material, and get back to me by correspondence as it relates to questions that you may have, so that we can make this a kind of dialogue between you, the listener, and me as it pertains to your particular interests and areas that you feel that we should be exploring. The basic ground rules of the series, as I see it, is that we want to provide a topical, comprehensive approach with appropriate references and documentation relating nutritional therapy, exercise, lifestyle modification to improved health. In order to make this more than just a didactic listening experience, I would like the listeners and the people who participate in this series to, in fact, be active contributors to its evolution and development. In order to do that, it's very important that you send back to the Northwest Academy office your comments, your questions, things that you feel that we should explore in greater detail, areas that we may have confused you with regard to explanations, or specific types of future topics that you feel would be important for us to cover. As this, in fact, occurs, I will be able to integrate your questions then into future tapes, and we can actually have a kind of communication going back and forth through the tapes that will be of general interest to all the listeners. This will make it more than just an audio cassette series, but I hope will become more of a kind of experience in which we're involved in the mutual education process and can share our clinical experiences and make this a hotline for quality nutritional education information. For those of you that are not familiar with my particular background and what brings me to the point of being involved in the formulation of these tapes, I'm a professor of nutritional biochemistry at the University of Puget Sound in Tacoma, Washington, which is a private liberal arts institution specializing in a general education, but with pretty significant emphasis on the sciences. As a member of the chemistry department, I've had the responsibility of developing research and teaching curricula in clinical chemistry and in physiological chemistry, as well as in nutritional biochemistry.
Well, that was yesterday. This is today. Dr. Bland, what did you think listening to that young man speaking on the tape recorder there?
Well, I'll tell you, Jay, it's very interesting. 20 years goes by awfully quickly, doesn't it? Kids grow up, life changes, some things don't change, and that is the whole focus that we've had over the 20 years is as similar and as vital today as it was in 1982. So I guess at one level I say, wow, that's amazing. At another level I say, we've been on our point, we've continued on our theme, and it's amazing how this field has evolved around us. I think we chose the right direction. We had a good pathfinder.
Well, in listening to that, I was really impressed with how, at that point, you had the vision and the focus and the format that you wanted to follow, and we've maintained a consistency over the years. In fact, I just finished, just last night, editing this year's seminar series and noticed that the focus was biochemical individuality, and listening to the rest of this tape, which we didn't play for our listeners, that was much of the material that was covered on that first issue was biochemical individuality. Roger Williams.
Yeah, I wish we would be able to share with Dr. Williams and Dr. Pauling right now this 20th anniversary. I recall that I did a fireside chat audio interview with Dr. Pauling a number of years ago. It was almost 20 years ago. It might have been, actually. Mm-hmm. And that was a marvelous experience for me. That tape still exists today. And I did also a similar interview with Dr. Williams when I was at the University of Texas visiting him probably like 17 years ago. And, you know, those were the group of people. There were probably 10 or 12 of them that really were the intellectual feedstock from which this field has grown up, and I feel very privileged to have been part of that generation to benefit from them.
Well, I can distinctly remember saying to you when we first started this project that a guy could probably make a full-time profession out of just following you around with a tape recorder, and it hasn't exactly been a full-time profession, but it's certainly been an ongoing, rewarding career for me to be the technical side of getting this thing done every month and all of the other things we've been able to do with the use of tape and now the advent of CD and in the future MP3 or whatever format evolves, the use of the internet. The horizon is very bright, not only for delivery of information, but the progress of functional medicine.
Well, I think that's beautifully said, and I look back at the times that we spent together, and actually even before Metabolic Update, at the Bellevue Redman Medical Clinic, at the Northwest Academy of Preventive Medicine, then later to become Metabolic Update, and then Preventive Medicine Update, and more recently now Functional Medicine Update. This has been an extraordinary journey for me to share with you. And it's interesting, I recall some humorous anecdotes, but one time you told me I had to be taking a tape recorder with me, and when I ran into interesting people, I had to be interviewing them. Mm-hmm. And I recall doing that once. One of our old Clinician of the Month interviews was done in the Sydney airport with a doctor down
that.
There. And after the quality was so poor, he said, Jeff, maybe you shouldn't take a tape recorder around with you anymore. So,
well, I remember that interview.
Yeah, I think you did because you spent hours on editing it because it was so poor. But, you know, we've learned, and I think the quality has continued to improve as the information in our field has continued to improve. And it's just been an extraordinary really enjoyment seeing the evolution of the docs who have been with us all these 20 years and how they have become the founding mothers and fathers of this whole field.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's more than a tape recorder now. It's actually a whole studio and combination of facilities. But in addition to looking back at the past 20 years, why don't we take a look forward? What's on the horizon for functional medicine?
Well, I think that's a very exciting time also. This is an auspicious moment in our 20th anniversary, and I think that leads us into a thoughtful reflection on my co-conspirator, so to speak, Dr. David Jones, and maybe we ought to have a little discussion with him about where we're heading in functional medicine.
Let's do it.
Well, you know, this 20th anniversary celebration is pretty special on a lot of levels, and one of them, of course, is the fact that my brother, through this whole process, Dr. David Jones and I conceived, along with my wife Susan Bland, now many years ago, the concept that we'd like to see functional medicine ultimately arise up to become an institutional educational opportunity as postgraduate training for practitioners that would affect in a positive way the delivery and outcome in healthcare. It's very exciting. Dr. Jones has, as you know, joined the IFM as its president over the past couple of years. David, maybe I should turn it over to you and have you announce the exciting news that kind of is symbolic of this 20th anniversary.
This is a very exciting month for the Institute of Functional Medicine on a number of different levels. It has been a dream of yours, Jeff, and Susan, and mine for well over 20 years that as we've journeyed together to take functional medicine to an educational institution level that is nonprofit and 501c3 classified, that it will have the highest level of accreditation, ACCME accreditation for continuing medical education. And in March of this year, and news just newly arrived, we have accomplished all three ambitions. The Institute of Functional Medicine is a legal non-for-profit in the state of Washington. It has gained its recognition as a 501c3 educational institution from the federal government, and we are now in a position to accept the opportunity for people to contribute to a 501c3 and the tax benefits that they get therefrom. We have gone through a process of a self-study with the National ACCME body, and we were found to be in compliance and actually qualified in a number of areas for excellence in our educational activities, and we go forward as now a well-accredited and recognized educational institution that is completely independent and has as its mission the spread of information, of the scientific basis for lifestyle management of complex and chronic illness, with the highest level of accreditation. We just finished a very successful applying functional medicine to clinical practice week-long seminar, and we just finished the evaluation of that yesterday, and we found, not to our surprise, that people feel that it's very clinically relevant, that the week they spend is one of the most useful weeks possible in the changing of the focus of their clinical experiences. So this is a very exciting time for us, and it's very appropriate that it comes right at this nexus of a 20 years of you, Jeff, producing a CME activity that has had such profound effects across the world. And in fact, this year we will be announcing the ability to track back through Functional Medicine Update as far back as 1996 or 97, and have all that available in a searchable CD. That's on the table. We have the technology to do it. It's going to be very exciting to have that available and be able to quickly scan through the data that's been provided for those years. This gives me an opportunity to celebrate with you, but also to acknowledge what an incredible influence you have been and how pleased I am to be continuing on that journey with you as we continue to explore what functional medicine can mean in clinical outcomes.
Well, thank you. I share that excitement about the journey with you and this whole process, and it's very exciting also that we've just completed our 9th International Symposium on Functional Medicine, again showing our own evolution, and I think the improvement in quality that we've been able to realize over the years, and next year will be our 10th. I guess it would have been a perfect numerology if we would have had our 10th on our 20th, but we had our 9th on our 20th. And I also want to acknowledge with you the extraordinary contributions that have been made by so many people with you at the head of the list to allow us to get to this 20th anniversary. And, you know, we have some subscribers, believe it or not, that have been with us all 20 years. It started with us back in June of 82 and have continued on since June of 82 all the way to 2002. So we've all kind of grown up together. That's pretty exciting.
Well, I would really like to echo that. If it takes a village or a community to raise a child, there is no question that it's taken a community, and I am so proud to be part of this community. And as we provide educational activities across the world and across the United States, networking with that body of our community has been a thrill for me. I know that you have come back every year empowered by how important what we're doing has been and how the contribution comes from such a large groundswell of very serious medical practitioners. And I'm now, in my capacity as president, I am interfacing and networking and see why you are so excited by the folks that are spread throughout the world.
Well, we thank you, and we look forward to celebrating the next 10-year anniversary, and it'll be bigger and better things. So thanks a million.
The title of this month's Functional Medicine Update, which I think is appropriate given the 20th anniversary, is Cancer, a Functional Disease Requiring Functional Medicine. It's a pretty presumptuous statement. Pretty bold. Why would I say such a thing? Over the course of the next 90 minutes, hopefully that theme will become more than an abstract concept, it'll become a reality. I believe that cancer is probably the most significant singular disease model that we can look at where functional medicine really is necessary for its remediation. The story starts somewhere around the Stockholm Karolinska study that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2000, a study that you are familiar with because we reviewed it in a previous issue of Functional Medicine Update, talking about the environmental and heritable factors in the causation of cancer, volume 343, page 78, in which the investigators did a twin study looking at twin retrospective data, 44,788 pairs of identical twins. As you know, if they were totally determined by their genes, that we would expect the concordance of cancer incidence in the two sets of twins to be very high. But if it was more an environmental effect on gene susceptibilities, then we would expect less concordance. And of course, the results of the study were quite remarkable, and for many of us, what we had previously thought, and that was very little concordance between the two sets of identical twins in cancer incidence, suggesting that no more than 25% of cancer risk is tied, hardwired into our genes. 75% or more is related to what we do to the genes, what washes over the genes, the experience, the function of those genes and their expression patterns. Simple things have profound influence on gene expression patterns and ultimate realization of the phenotype of disease or the phenotype of health compression and high-level function and increased health span, so to speak. Let me use an example, and that is exercise. If someone was to ask you, would you invest in a company that had a new drug that single agent would lower blood pressure, reduce cardiovascular disease risk, improve cognition, improve sleep, reduce stress, improve immunity, strengthen your bones, improve your muscle mass, give you greater states of cognitive alertness, and have profound influences on improving insulin sensitivity, you would say, there is the panacea drug. That is a blockbuster that cannot lose. I'm investing in that company. And, of course, you know what I'm talking about, because exercise, strength and conditioning exercises, both aerobic and resistance exercises, Bill Evans, one of our previous Functional Medicine Update Clinicians of the Month, talked about, will accomplish all of those goals. And, in fact, in the New England Journal of Medicine recently, a paper entitled Exercise Capacity and Mortality Among Men Referred for Exercise Testing. This was the New England Journal of Medicine this year, 2002, volume 346, page 793. And in this particular study, they found that all-cause mortality was most strongly linked to exercise performance as tested with an exercise EKG. Not just cardiovascular mortality, but all-cause mortality. And that it was probably the best predictor of the simple, non-invasive ways of assessing the trajectory towards health or disease. In fact, the conclusion of the paper they say as follows. Exercise capacity is a more powerful predictor of mortality among men than other established risk factors for cardiovascular disease, including such things as cholesterol, LDL, HDL ratios. Simple things can have profound influence. Let's move to cancer, because there is a condition that is certainly a dreaded, feared, psychophobic condition, different than any other disease in the way that it has a social spectrum and its response by both the individual who has the disease and the society in response to it. The general theme in cancer treatment has been complete loss of any foreign invading cells by killing them through chemotherapeutic or radiotherapeutic or surgical methods. This is kind of your concept of take no prisoners. And so one might ask the question, how do you really design a strategy and a series of experiments to evaluate risk-benefit or cost-effectiveness of different approaches towards cancer treatment in comparing that strategy, the take-no-prisoner strategy, to strategies that would engage the body in immunological potentiation, in functional improvement that we might call lifestyle intervention? And this question of study design for doing cost-effectiveness analysis in clinical trials is a huge issue right now within methodological circles. There's a very interesting paper that was published recently in the Annual Review of Public Health. This is in the 2001 issue, page 129, talking about this design issues. And they go on to say that cost-effectiveness studies require comprehensive evaluations of outcomes other than just typical endpoints measured in clinical trials. Comprehensive endpoints to really evaluate cost-effectiveness should include things such as quality of life measures that prove useful for interpreting other endpoints other than that which may be objectively measured in the trial and ultimately lead us into a more comprehensive decision-making process. How do you include these variables, quality of life variables, improvement of the health span, a functional ability, other than just looking at single parameters of did we show negative on a histopathology evaluation, on cytology, or on a blood chemical test? What was the quality of the patient's life? How were they doing? You know, we all have some finiteness to our life. There's not a single one of us that doesn't recognize that our life has a terminal endpoint in which it will move on to another place. That energy that we've had will transcend, move on, and have a different form. Energy is conserved. It's never lost. So that is an inevitable part of this process. But the question is, what is the quality that's compressed within those years of living? And how does that relate to the therapies that we might be delivering as a consequence of a person who has whatever disease that is diagnosed? And what is the probability of recovery from that disease after undergoing the cost, both financial cost and emotional and physical cost for that treatment? These are very powerful questions that have not gotten adequate sway in clinical decision making. And in fact, as this particular paper discusses in design issues related for conducting cost-effectiveness trials, that we ought to be really looking at a broader array of variables in decision-making other than just the short-term variables, looking at specific analytes and whether they were or were not present in specific tissues before or after therapy. Well, let's move to cancer specifically and start applying this model. And let's look at those mechanisms that we know lead to unregulated cell growth. One of those mechanisms, signaling molecules that cause mitogenic cell replication, moving cells from states of rest in their cell cycling to states of rapid metabolic activity, mitotic turnover, cell division, replication. During these periods of time where cells are rapidly dividing, there's more opportunity for injurious events to occur on the replicative machinery, the genome of the cell. And if these mutations occur at specific regions of the genome that operate and control specific critical functions in cell personality, like the P53 tumor suppressor gene, then these mutations can result in significant alterations in how that cell cycles. It can become dedifferentiated, monoclonal, invasive, and replicative, meaning a cancer cell. Compounds, molecules that enhance mitotic cellular turnover and activity are those that therefore are associated with increased oncological risk. Of those kinds of molecules, one that has gotten into the news considerably are the estrogen molecules, which we know enhance mitotic activity and genomic cycling in certain cell types, like the breast, endometrium, prostate, and ovaries. So the question has really been raised, what are the cost-effectiveness ratios related to hormone replacement therapy with estrogen in women? This is a very interesting question, which is extraordinarily complicated and has been, to a great extent, distanced from coming to an unequivocal answer to the question. Recently, however, in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 2002, a paper was published entitled Hormone Replacement Therapy in Relation to Breast Cancer. This is volume 287, page 734, in which the authors point out that data adds to this growing body of evidence that long-term use of hormone replacement therapy, and in this case it was specifically looking at mixed conjugated equine estrogens and medroxyprogesterone acetate, is associated with an increased risk of breast cancer, and that such use may be related particularly to lobular tumors in the breast. Therefore, it's not without some risk that a woman would engage in the symptom management intervention using estrogen replacement therapy, mixed conjugated equine estrogens. Why is this therapy still continued then in the face of this advancing information? It's continued because the symptoms that the woman experiences as she goes into perimenopause can be so debilitating and so anguishing that she wishes escape at almost any price, knowing that the relative risk statistically of breast cancer is very small. If it was so glaringly obvious, we would obviously have that therapy disallowed. But it's somewhat like smoking and lung cancer. Does every smoker get lung cancer? Of course not. And what has the tobacco industry been able to effectively do for decades? Say, there's no unequivocal evidence that smoking causes lung cancer. It's just associative evidence. However, as the evidence mounts more and more from animal studies, from in vitro studies, from cell culture studies, from human epidemiological studies, eventually it becomes so overwhelming and loud that a decision is so obvious that smoking does cause lung cancer, particularly in those individuals who have specific types of susceptibility. Similarly, we might apply the argument to that of estrogen replacement therapy, mixed conjugated equine estrogens, and breast cancer in women. So if we start looking at who are those women that are more susceptible to these mitogenic changes that occur in breasts as a consequence of taking molecules that amplify cell cycling and alter genomic expression, we might ask it has something to do possibly with the metabolism of those estrogen molecules and their influence on cell receptors and genomic messaging. And that is reviewed in this January 21st issue, 2002, of the New England Journal of Medicine, page 346, entitled Production and Action of Estrogens. And in this article, they go on to point out that it's not just estrogens themselves, such as estrone and estradiol, but it is their metabolites, their hydroxylated byproducts that occur as a consequence of hepatic and breast hydroxylation reactions that produce the 4 and the 16 and the 2 hydroxylated estrogens that have differing influences on cell cycling. The 4 hydroxylated estrogens, when they become methoxylated through the activity of an enzyme catechol-methyltransferase to produce the 2 methoxy estrogens, are anti-estrogens, estrogen breaks, whereas the 4 methoxylated estrogens and the 4 hydroxy estrogens can have differing influences on cell regulation. And in fact, the 4 hydroxy estrogens can be oxidized into the quinones, which can be apurinic and damage the DNA of the breast and the endometrium and the ovaries and increase oncogenic risk. Therefore, it's the metabolism of estrogen. And what we are learning is that these metabolites are nutritionally modifiable based upon specific agents that manipulate or influence the function of gene expression and proteomic outcome. And therefore now, for the first time, mechanisms which nutrition play a role in chemo prevention are starting to become more well understood. It's not just statistical, epidemiological, take the luck of the draw. It's what women with what specific genotypes may be at what risk, and what are the nutrients that modify that genotypic susceptibility into a phenotype that is not a cancer phenotype. So estrogen action becomes the theme of the story. It's binding to the receptor site. It's transport by sex-binding hormone globulin. It's translocation to the nucleus. It's then setting up an intercellular communication mechanism. What metabolites, and does it relate to what the plasma concentrations are of the sulfated derivatives and the glucose?